Welcome to chapter 2. This is the end of the semester. What's going on here? Why are we going to chapter 2? Well, dear students, I disagree strongly with the author's placement of this chapter. They want you to understand how to buy and sell securities before you even know what they are. And in my humble opinion, that is putting the cart before the horse, as the saying goes. Specifically, they go into detail about buying on margin and selling short, which is something that's pretty darn dangerous and kind of tricky. In fact, those are two of the trickiest parts of the Series 7 exam, so that's why we put it at the end, okay? But first, we're going to discuss brokerage firms. We'll spend a little bit of time discussing brokerage firms, and then we'll get into the scary, tricky, dangerous techniques of buying on margin and selling short. Slide number 2. There are three categories of brokerage firms, although there's not always a distinct demarcation between the three. You have the full-service traditional brokerage firms such as Merrill Stench and Morgan Stupid. I'm sorry, Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley, UBS. Those are the big boys and girls, and there are fewer of them than there used to be because of consolidation. And then you have discount brokers, which the niche now is filled pretty much with Schwab, although there are many of these A.G. Edwards and Edward Joneses, sometimes called mom-and-pop shops, LPL Financial, although they have their own recommendation systems and their own analytical departments. Schwab is the big player in the discount brokerage firm category. And then there are the deep discount brokers, internet brokers that have emphasized technology to reduce brokerage costs dramatically. Well, obviously all three of them have been doing that, and they have not all stood still while the internet brokers came on. No, not at all. What can you expect to pay for each? What kind of service can you expect from each? Well, let's take a look at commissions then and now. Traditionally, virtually all brokerage firms made their money from commissions. Full-service brokers would charge you $70, $100 or more per trade. The discount brokerage firms started in the late 70s into the 80s at $45, then down to $29, $19, $13, $9, I think is what Schwab charges now. And the discount brokers are now very, very cheap, $5. Some were up to 18, but no, we're talking $5 a trade. And mutual fund companies have gotten into the act. Fidelity and Vanguard have their own brokerage firms now, and they will give you free commissions on their own funds, which is very, very smart. A few companies have experimented with $0 commissions, the most famous being now Robinhood, although I heard there might be another one entering the fold. One that started several years ago, that failed. Another one now charges $5 a trade. But Robinhood is very popular, especially with the younger folks. They have emphasized mobile computing. Oh, but wait a minute. How can a brokerage firm make any money with a $0 commission? I mean, in fact, how can companies make money with $5 or $7 a trade? What do you think, huh? Slide number 4. Do you remember this slide from chapter 5? Scott Trade Incorporated receives remuneration for directing orders to particular broker-dealers or market centers for execution. Such remuneration is considered compensation to the firm, and the source and amount of any compensation received by the firm in connection with your transaction will be disclosed upon request. What does that mean? I hope by now you understand what it means. They're getting a kickback. They are sending your trade to a particular market maker or particular broker dealer who's not giving you the best deal, and is taking that tiny little bit of money that they're overcharging you and giving it back to Scott Trade or E-Trade or whoever, or Robinhood. It's called Order Flow, which I think is a really stupid name. And we discussed this way back in Chapter 5. So that's how they're making their money. And also, Scott Trade keeps saying, oh, we're going to make money by, not Scott Trade, I'm sorry, yeah, Robinhood. We're going to start charging interest by using margin accounts. But then they came out with this announcement that they're going to have checking accounts that pay interest. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, they're not going to do that. And I was right. Within a day, the Securities Exchange Commission, the Federal Reserve Bank said, no, you're not a bank. Shut up. You can't do that. And they did. They shut up. Slide number 5. As competition for your business has gotten fiercer, the methods of charging investors for investment services have gotten more creative. So there are alternative methods to charge customers for their brokerage services. A long time ago, Merrill Lynch experimented with just charging $3,000 a year for unlimited trades. Well, they don't have that anymore. But there are many other methods. But the new modern-day agogo way to stab your customers in the back. I'm sorry. Charge for brokerage services is called wealth management. We discussed mutual funds. Slide number 6, a wealth management account, a wrap account, a financial advisor account, a registered investment advisor account. They go by various names. But instead of charging per transaction, the brokerage firms tack on a yearly 1 or 2% wealth management fee. Remember the mutual fund F shares? These types of programs are being pushed by all the major and not so major full-service brokerage firms. And there are many flavors of this program. Look, folks, I'm a broker, right? You want me to work for you? You pay me a commission, and I'll do what you need me to do, right? And be done with it. You pay the commission, and that's it. With these wealth management fees, you're going to wind up spending a whole lot more money if you're in it for the long term. Obviously, if you're not, if you're a short-term investor, then the 1% fee might turn out to be a godsend because you're buying and selling and buying and selling all the time. In fact, I've seen one of these things, and I'm tempted to put it up on the website. I don't know what will happen if I do. I mean, I'll block out all the account information. But this, I'm afraid Fidelity might sue me. But this woman was being just, I don't even know where to begin to explain what they were doing. They were just buying and selling willy-nilly, probably some computer algorithm, and she was making $3 here, losing $2 there, and the fee was sometimes a penny, sometimes there was no fee. But it was just absolutely mind-numbingly stupid. And they were charging her 1.2% a year to do this. They're making tons of money. And I don't know if she was making any money. It was ridiculous. The latest wrinkle in this, so it goes without saying. Hope you realize that I don't have any clients to do this. If they wanted me to do this, I would try to talk them out of it by saying, I don't think it's in your best interest. You're going to wind up spending a whole lot more than just buying and holding, which is what I do for my own account, what I recommend that you do for your own account, and obviously for you students, we've talked about the benefits of buying and holding. I mean, not blindly, but still, holding on to your investments for the long term, and that pay the commission and be done. Well, anyway, what can I say? I'm old. But the latest wrinkle in this method is the new performance-based wealth management program. Slide number 7. Only pay your advisor when you make money. The advisor receives 10 or 20% of your earnings when you make money, and they receive nothing when you lose money or you don't make anything. It's a variation of the way that hedge funds charge their shareholders, and it's marketed to high net worth wealth investors. I remember this guy from Dunham & Associates saying, we look for people who can write a check for $1 million. Good for you. These people don't need our help. I mean, talking about brokerage firms. I mean, obviously they want to have a somebody serves their interests and is a good broker and a good financial advisor. But they're okay. You know, it's the people making who can put $50 a month away. They're the ones who need help. But anyway, here was their plan. If you made money in a quarter, they did it on a quarterly basis, then they would charge you 10% of whatever you made. Sorry, 1%. They'd take 1% of what of any gain you made. Am I making any sense? Let's say you made 10%. They would take one of it. They'd take 1%. They'd take 10% of any money you make. That's right, 10% of any money you make. But what if you didn't make any money? What if your investment went down or stayed the same? They would not take anything. So they called it fulcrum investing. If you made money, they took 10% of what you made. And if you didn't make any money, they didn't take anything. They've since changed that. Because this was before the Great Recession. And of course, I was thinking at the time when I heard this was back in 2006 or 7, I was thinking, you know, what happens if there's a prolonged bear market? These people are going to be really in trouble. And obviously now, they now charge a little bit. They charge a little bit if you don't make any money. Because they got to stay in business, right? They got to keep the doors open. One other thing is interesting. Some of the mutual funds have started doing this. AllianceBernstein, AB. Remember way back in Chapter 4, we looked at the large cap growth fund? Yeah, the large cap growth funds. Very good fund. Very good fund. They've changed their fee structure so that when the I'm not sure if it's quarterly or yearly, when the mutual fund makes money, they charge you their normal management fee. But when the mutual fund loses money, the fee goes down to a fee that is typical of index funds. So in other words, they're trying to say, look, you don't like us because we're not an index fund. Look, we beat the – and they have. They've beaten the indices very handily over several years now. So the fee will go down. So you see what's going on now? They're playing on this idea that we will charge you when you make money, and we won't charge you if you don't make money. And although it sounds tempting, the reality is that you have the potential to pay far, far more for your investment services. Why? Because they're taking 10 or 20% of anything you make. So let's say that's a good year and the market goes up 20%. They're going to take 2 to 4% of that. Right? So you only make 16% as opposed to 20%. Pay the darn commission and be done with it. However, dear students, if you are a do-it-yourself kind of person and you've learned the techniques and internalize them that we have studied in this class, and you do feel that you can buy and sell on your own, then great. Why should you pay brokerage fees? Why should you pay a broker for your help, for recommendations? And the answer is you shouldn't. So there are places that allow you to do direct investments, dividend reinvestment plans, direct low-cost investment plans, DRIPs. Remember these from Chapter 5? Bypass the middleman. Many of the large, well-established companies offer their own dividend reinvestment plans, either totally free or pretty darn close. Do you remember the? Go back to Chapter 5. The Sempra, San Diego Gas and Electric. We had a DRIP through them in the investment club I was in. And they would charge us 3 cents or 5 cents every once in a while. So it's very, very low cost. What's the downside? Well, if you have 18 stocks and you go to each individual stock, you're going to have 18 different statements. So that's a bit of a, not a big deal, but it's a bit of a problem. So there are entities that will aggregate them for you. $10 a month or something like that. There's a company, it's the National Association of Investors Corporation. They now call themselves betterinvesting.org. They're the folks who sponsor the investment clubs and an excellent, excellent group. I've been trying to get somebody, a representative from them, to come speak to our investment club at Southwestern, and I used to be a member of investment club, and I hope to do that again when I retire, when I have time, and don't have this website to keep alive. It sometimes feels like a tiger, you know, if you got to keep feeding it or it's going to eat you. And so, and there used to be a San Diego chapter. And again, there's another idea for me if and when I retire. Restart our San Diego chapter. Get involved with that because now you have to go up to LA. But they're a great group, and they use a company called Folio FN. So you can get all your stocks and aggregate them there and do dividend reinvestment plans and pay very, very little for your brokerage services. Cool? Yeah, think about it. Especially if you, as we've discussed, emphasize large companies that pay, you know, generous dividends and raise their dividends over time and have the roots deep in the economy. It's not for those folks who are, you know, buying the hottest new stocks and selling them within 3 months or something like that. It's not for aggressive growth investors. It's for us buy and hold, stodgy, boring kind of people. Cool? Okay, now. Of course, if you have any questions about individual brokerage firms, you can ask me. You can also go to FINRA.org, and check out their history, because all of them we have. You can look up me and see if there's any hanky panky. So far, no, so good. I haven't gotten any disciplinary action. But of course, you know, contact me, and I'll tell you right off the bat, folks. Here's a plug for a competitor. I don't get any kickback. But I've been impressed by what Schwab has done for individual investors. So check out Schwab. They're a pretty good company. But there are dozens of very good companies, folks. So, and then there's a lot of Merrill Stenches and Morgan Stanleys of the world. Okay, now, I could talk about brokerage firms and brokers and all kinds of hanky-panky that's gone on for a long time, folks. But a lot of good people in the industry, I must say. I've met very good people in the industry. So now, in our next two presentations, we're going to discuss the things that we've been dancing around. We told you about buying on margin, which it turns out there's actually some good reason to do this, possibly in your situation, depending on who you are and how long you've been investing and what your personal financial situation is. And then we'll discuss selling short, shorting stocks, which in my humble opinion is something you should never do. And if that means anything to you, Peter Lynch says never to short stocks. And who am I to argue with Peter Lynch? So we'll see you in our next two presentations on buying on margin and selling stocks short selling. See ya.